Good evening, everybody. We want to welcome you to the round table tonight on Philadelphia, the place that loves you back. I'm Howard Gillette. I'm a co-editor of the Encyclopedia of Greater Philadelphia, along with Charlene Myers, who is going to be moderating our panel tonight. Normally, she'd be making the welcome to all of you. If you've been to these sessions before, you know that she knows more about this project than anybody else, but she's going to master the intricacies of a great panel that we have before us. Our format will be as we have proceeded in the past. We will hear from the panelists, some dialogue between them. We'll have questions and answers from the audience, and then we're going to break into some smaller groups, and we have some discussion leaders for those groups for the last 20-25 minutes of our session this afternoon. Encyclopedia Philadelphia, Greater Philadelphia, if you haven't heard much about it so far, is an online civic project. We have many partners, some of whom are represented in this room tonight, who are working together to aggregate our historical information and to tie it into our understanding of the city and its region, and to think through this aggregation of information more about who we are and where we want to go. And of course, one of the big issues about tourism is not only do we know our own city and region to be able to communicate to others, but can we convey to others what a special place this is and how it has a power through its history to shape our lives and to engage people in a variety of different ways. So it is an ongoing project. We welcome your participation both in these sessions, and there are several more to come, and also in your comments, which we hope you will provide, both through the evaluation forms that you have before you at your seat. And if you have comments about topics that we should cover, there's a separate sheet for that. Some of you are veterans and clearly have filled those out before, but hopefully all of you will evaluate the session that you have here tonight, which is kicked off by an essay that I hope most of you have seen either in the Sunday Inquirer or online on the Encyclopedia website under the title of tonight's session, Philadelphia, the City That Loves You Back, written by Richardson Dilworth, who's one of our panelists. I do want to recognize Lori Zurer, the director of the Pennsylvania Humanities Council, who's in our audience tonight. We want to thank Lori and her colleagues for funding these roundtables. We're very grateful for the support of the Pennsylvania Humanities Council, and we're working with the council to build this set of roundtables into a long-lasting project, both online and ultimately in print, with the University of Pennsylvania Press as our partner to create a online encyclopedia. I'm sorry, a print encyclopedia someday in the near or distant future. I don't want to take any more time. I'd like to turn the microphone over to Charlene Myers and welcome you once again. Thanks for coming out tonight.
Thank you, Howard. So we have a number of partners in the audience. I want to mention especially the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. I saw Kim Sayet just come in a few minutes ago. Kim, you're back in the back. And Beth Wishouding is here, and we have other staff members from HSP. Thank you very much. And allow me to introduce first our distinguished panelists who will be joining me in conversation. I'm going to introduce them just briefly, and then as the evening goes on, you'll learn more about them and their perspectives on tonight's discussion on tourism and tourism promotion. We have, of course, with us tonight Richardson Dilworth, who's seated in the middle. He's the author of the essay that you read in the paper or perhaps online. He's associate professor of political science and director of the Center for Public Policy at Drexel University. We're also very pleased to have with us Merrill Levitz, president and CEO of the Greater Philadelphia Tourism and Marketing Corporation, which you'll hear referred to tonight, I'm sure, as the GPTMC. Thank you for joining us. And to my far right, also is Bob Skiba, who is president of the Association of Philadelphia Tour Guides, as well as director of the John J. Wilcox Jr. Library and Archives at the William Wade Community Center. So we're in for a great discussion among these panelists. I thought I would set the scene a little bit, first about tourism and its history in Philadelphia and the region. Tourism, of course, has been shaping the way that we view our city and region and how others view our city and region for a long, long time. And clearly, tourism is a major factor today. I witnessed this building, right, opened in 2001, which shows the large investments that Philadelphians today are willing to make in support of services for visitors. All around us are historic sites and museums and landscapes that are shaped by the interests of tourism and our desire to attract tourists to our region. But of course, tourism isn't a new phenomenon. That term, tourism, meaning to travel for pleasure, actually first came into use in the early 19th century. And it was used disparagingly at the time. I think perhaps the whole idea of leisure travel implied too much elitism or self-indulgence for that era of industrialization and democracy and turmoil. But there we have it. And I think it's very interesting to think about that period as it connects with Philadelphia's history. So if you think back to that era, what was happening with Philadelphia at the time when tourism was taking shape as a concept? What was the period when Philadelphia lost its prominence, right, as a state capital, as a national capital, as the leader of population, as the leader of trade? But still, tourists came to Philadelphia. They knew it as the Quaker City, or the city of brotherly love, or the cradle of liberty. Phrases that were attached to our city by history and reputation, rather than by self-conscious tourism promotion. So it was a different time. People also thought of Philadelphia as the Athens of America, as we've discussed previously in this series, a reflection of the city's arts and culture. And what did they come to see? By the 1800s, Philadelphia already had a history that was old. But the people who came as tourists, especially in the first half of the 19th century, came to see what was new. At the Eastern State Penitentiary, the Fairmount Waterworks, Girard College, and they participated in the living history of the city. They went to church services, often many different church services. They observed court trials. They visited hospital wards. Right? There was a great fascination with asylums of all kinds, and tourists went to see those things. In the countryside, they sought out the sublime surroundings of the Wissahickon, or later Fairmount Park. And yes, some did go to see Independence Hall or the Liberty Bell. But you know, until 1828, when that steeple that we just nicely restored again was reconstructed, Independence Hall was not much to look at, right, for the 19th century visitor. And until the 1850s, there was also not much to see inside. The Liberty Bell didn't start gaining its reputation as an icon until the 1830s and 1840s. So those were not the prime attractions for that earlier period. But the new attractions of the 19th century, are, of course, the historic attractions of today. And I think one of the really interesting things about the history of tourism for Philadelphia is this sort of mix and convergence of the old and the new, and the way that one becomes the other. There's also some tension there, I think, that goes back perhaps to the centennial of 1876, and we might talk about this a little, when that anniversary of the Declaration of Independence was celebrated by a big World's Fair that was all about technology, right, the newest thing. So we have the old and the new. Through the 20th century, Philadelphia's promoters worked hard to position the city as more than a sleepy town with old brick buildings. And I know some of you in the room recall the slogans of the 1960s, a few of them that I know, summertime is fun time in Philadelphia, surprising Philadelphia, and Philadelphia fling, right, to attract the visitors in Philadelphia. And sometimes promoters struggled with mixed messages of the old and new. There was a radio contest in 1959 that encouraged Philadelphians to visit Independence Hall, and you would go and you would drop a card in, but the prize was a week's vacation away from Philadelphia to the exotic new state of Hawaii. So I think this tension, these intersections between old and new, are reflected in Richard Dilworth's essay, which brings us into the most recent period of tourism and tourism promotion in Philadelphia's history and provides the start for our discussion this evening. To get us started and to allow you to get to know the panelists a little bit better, I've asked each of them in turn to tell us something about a tourist experience that they recall and also to say a few words about their perspective on tourism. And I think we'll begin with Richard so that we can hear a brief summary of his major points in his essay.
Thanks. Do I need to use a microphone?
No. Can I think you should, yeah.
You should? Okay. Is this on? Okay. I grew up in a large part of my childhood. I was spent growing up in Society Hill, right around all of the tourist exhibits, and it never occurred to me that tourists actually came to them. I went to them and played around at them, at Penn's Landing and at the old post office. I couldn't think of when it actually occurred to me that people would come to Philadelphia to see those things. But I want to talk more specifically about the place that left you back, about the essay I wrote. I'd like to say, first of all, that I really like that slogan, and I think it's a successful slogan. I think by virtue of the fact that we're...
Can you speak up a bit more? I'm sorry.
Sure, is that...
I'm in the
last part.
Thank you.
Is that good?
Okay. Yes,
I think the place that loves you back is a successful slogan. I mean, obviously, the fact that we're here talking about it is evidence that it's a successful slogan. I think it's a successful slogan specifically because it's a confusing slogan. And from everything that I've been able to find, articles that I've looked up in reaction to the slogan when it was first produced, that was one of the chief responses to it was confusion. And I think for that reason it's somewhat compelling, because it's not just confusing in terms of creating chaos. I think it's confusing because it makes some sense, but it's confusing as to first of all how a place can experience an emotion like love, and why it would love you back, and why this would be Philadelphia, and if it's Philadelphia or what is the place that's referred to. Because it doesn't actually say Philadelphia loves you back, it just says the place that loves you back. The one thing I want to say about that too is that I've always found that a compelling slogan. I edited a book that came out in 2006 called Social Capital in the City, and I put that together in part so that I could write a chapter that I could entitle The Place That Loves You Back, because I like that slogan so much. I didn't live in Philadelphia when the slogan was introduced, and when the entire lifespan of that slogan, I didn't live in Philadelphia. But somehow I heard it and it stuck with me, which I think is more evidence of its power and its impact. Now, just in terms of the essay that I wrote that was in the Inquirer, the major point that I make is that I think I use it as a means for referring back to what I think was a sort of prevailing reputation of Philadelphia as being an antisocial place that I think you can trace through most of Philadelphia's history, and until possibly the 1990s. And I think for a variety of reasons, Philadelphia benefited from a larger sort of national trend and sensibility about the role of cities. And specifically the role of older traditional cities as places of community and oddly enough places of warm community, which I think was a pretty fundamental watershed change in our understanding and conception of large American cities. We'll finish saying, and then I'll move on because we only have 5 minutes, that my argument in that essay is in large part I use the essay as a way to discuss Philadelphia's antisocial reputation, but more so than its antisocial reputation, the fact that its antisocial reputation actually, was part of the city's chief virtues as well, which is the longstanding virtues of tolerance and that come from the Quaker heritage, so that it was more complicated than just simply being a negative reputation. It was a negative reputation that was bound in with the city's virtues as well, which I think you can use to explain why then that there's some evidence to suggest that Philadelphians took some pride in that antisocial reputation. I say all that, and I say that with a lot of hesitance, because as a social scientist, I also am very dubious of cultural explanations. And my general sort of academic orientation is to suggest that organizations and things like places like cities don't have feelings, don't have agency in any way, that only individuals have feelings and the ability to act and the ability, you know, to experience conscious emotions. So when talking about something like a city, there's frequently this tendency to speak of cities as individuals themselves, which I don't understand and struggle with. And in writing an essay in which I was ascribing cultural characteristics to a city, I found myself on somewhat uneasy ground, but one that I couldn't avoid, because there is a compelling collective imagination about a specific place that clearly doesn't describe most of the realities that are actually lived in that place, but that sometimes has some form of that has some meaning and weight to it that I find somewhat personally mysterious, and I'm just going to conclude with that and then pass on the microphone.
Thank you. Maybe Meryl would like to follow.
Sure. Thanks, and I'm very glad you liked it. I'm glad I came tonight. I learned a lot. And each word in that slogan was chosen very carefully and took weeks and weeks and weeks with many choices, and maybe we'll get into that a little later. Early tourist experience came to Philadelphia. My mom and dad were taking my sister, my three brothers, and me on an American pilgrimage from Chicago, Illinois, and on the day that we were going to stop in Philadelphia, it rained, so we kept going. So that was my first almost tourist experience to Philly, and we went to D.C. where it was really hot. And I do remember a few things about that trip, and we really enjoyed it, but it was really hot. The next time I thought about Philadelphia wasn't until years later, when I was married and my husband had just, received his doctorate in psychology, and so he was being recruited by different schools around the country. And the first school that he was recruited by was in a little town in the Midwest where I didn't want to go. And I mentioned that, and that there were probably several other places where, although I was really happy with him, I really didn't want to go. So he said, well, let's make up two lists. And he grew up above Yankee Stadium, the old Yankee Stadium in New York. So we made a list of the places we would want to go and a list of the places we wouldn't want to go. We put them both on the fridge. And when University of Pennsylvania called, we looked to see which list Philly was on. And it wasn't on either list. So we said, well, that's interesting. Why would that be? And we decided to come out anyway. And so we flew out and rented a car and tried to find Philadelphia. And we looked for the skyline and couldn't find it. And we looked for waterfronts and couldn't find them. And that was before GPS and everything else. And we got pretty lost. So we saw a number of different neighborhoods in Philadelphia without knowing exactly where we were at any point. But that was in 1971. We said we'd stay a couple years, and we're still here. So there is something about the place, and we did definitely say place instead of city for various reasons that just grabbed us. I live in New Jersey, so I feel that I come to Philadelphia every day as a tourist and see something new and think about it in different ways, which I guess is what we'll talk about later. My mother, the other attachment that I had to it, my mother, who grew up in Western Pennsylvania, really, really poor, in depression time, and despite the fact that she was valedictorian in her class and all that stuff, really couldn't afford to go to college, and so scrimped and saved to get to Philadelphia, where she enrolled in Pierce. And so that was my first touchstone here, and took the secretarial course at Pierce, and then got a job as the executive assistant to the editor of a paper that existed at that time, Philadelphia Record. And I think Felix Salyer, that name sticks in my mind. You might know that. At any rate, she worked for the editor of the paper and as such was hearing what was going on in the world at the time and quit to enlist in the WAX and join the Army, where she met my dad in England. So I had some fond connections with Philly. So that was that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Bob? Thank you. As a tour guide here in Philadelphia, I feel like I'm one of the people who kind of catches the ball that Maryland GPTMC throw out to all of us. And we owe a big debt to GPTMC because I think they've done more for tourism in this city than any other organization. But once visitors are here, it's up to those of us who are in the hospitality and tourism industry to make sure that visitors enjoy their experience, they tell their friends about it, and they want to return for more. I think that the image that Philadelphia presents to the world is bound up with how we Philadelphians view our own city. The things that make the city appealing to the tourist for a weekend are exactly the same things that make Philadelphia a viable city to live in. As a historian, as a tour guide, I was drawn to Philadelphia because of its rich and complex history, but I stay here because of what it has to offer today: arts, culture, restaurants, political discourse, and diversity. Many of the things that New York has to offer, but on a more human scale and at two-thirds the cost. Philadelphia as a city is more closely tied to its founder than any other city I think I've lived in. And there's a reason that William Penn is on the top of City Hall. Penn was a tourist. He was a guide, and he was certainly our first promoter, all rolled into one. He toured the Lenape villages. He learned what he could and wrote back to England about them. To entice settlers to his green country town, he published brochures, which he distributed all over Europe, praising Pennsylvania as fertile soil, temperate climate, and even its booming restaurant scene, saying, "There are 7 pubs for entertainment of strangers and good meals to be had for 6p." And finally, he offered it something no other colony here could: a place where all religions and philosophies were welcome and an economic atmosphere where business could thrive. What he did simply worked. It's the reason that Philadelphia settled later than Boston or New York, soon surpassed them in population, to become the largest city in America at the time of independence. 100 years later, Philadelphia was in the spotlight again in 1876, as Charlene said, for the Centennial Exhibition. We celebrated not only our history and our part in the birth of our country, but we showcased our technology and our manufacturing as well. Hotels sprung up all over the city. Residents even rented out spare rooms to guests. Nearly 10 million visitors attended that exhibition at a time when the population of our country was only about 45 million. That's almost a quarter of the population of the country. That's a good statistical return, I think. Today, we're still trying to balance that pride we have in the part we played in American history with everything else that we have to offer to visitors. I came to Philadelphia first in the early 1980s, and I thought it was a horrible place, I have to say. I thought it was dirty and unfriendly and all the things that people have ever said bad about Philadelphia. But I moved here in 1998, almost sight unseen, only having been here once before, a long time before. In the past dozen years that I've lived here, I think I've seen Philadelphia and Philadelphians' own view of their city change for the better. I see a city that's more self-confident, more energetic, and yes, more welcoming. I'm really happy to be part of the hospitality and tourism industry here. As president of ATT, I had the pleasure to be in contact with so many guides who love this city with something that borders on obsession, but who are always happy to share that love they have with their city with every single visitor who comes here. Thanks.
Thanks very much. So we're going to turn now to a discussion of tourism promotion, and I think it would make sense for us to start with Meryl so that you can talk more about the slogans. And I've asked the panel to help us think through how tourism promotions in general communicate about our city and region.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Charlene. And the first thing I want to say is that we're really honored that the place that loves you back was even considered for this project. Thanks on behalf of everybody who's worked with GPTMC. Want to introduce Patricia Washington, our Vice President of Cultural Tourism right back there, who's been with us for how long? 12 years. So thank you for that and for what you wrote about it. Yes, when the slogan was introduced, it was met with the same kind of reaction. I don't know if this is on. Is it? Is this helping? Okay. That when Nike introduced Just Do It, one of the most successful slogans of all time, people said, just do what? You know, and what is that thing? And when New York came out with I Love New York, people said, love New York. I hate the taxes. I was mugged. My tires were slashed. The public education, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so we really did expect that this would happen. But we had the challenge because those of you who were here back in 1994 know that Pew Charitable Trust took on the challenge of figuring out what would be a good replacement industry for the lost manufacturing jobs in Philadelphia. And the consultant they hired in New York, Parter and Associates, said hospitality would, and they said, hospitality? Is that even an industry? Yes. Although it doesn't have a smokestack and a big parking lot with 1,500 spaces, it actually is an industry. And so they did a study to see what would impact this industry most, and they came up with three things. One of them you're sitting in. The second one is GPTMC. And the third one was a sort of psychological approach to look into the Philadelphia psyche and see what this deeply felt neurosis was that Philadelphians had that made them either not talk about or talk in a dismissive manner about their own city, which, coming from Chicago, that was one of the first astonishing things I found about Philadelphia is, you know, why aren't these people smiling more? This is not a bad place. So at any rate, we were given 3 years to move the needle. We did no advertising at all the first year because no one had even bothered thinking about whether anybody would want to come to Philadelphia, as you said. So they really didn't know where to start. So we did about a year of research before we announced the slogan in April of 1997 on the steps of the Art Museum, I believe we all were. And some of the slogans that we turned down, I dug and looked, were Philly Plus, bigger than the bell, another Philadelphia town and country, America at its most original, Philadelphia country, it's more than a day trip, Philadelphia for the pursuit of happiness, yours, another one, find your Philadelphia, in and around Philadelphia, and the Philadelphias, my weekend planet. So I can't tell you. Yeah, thanks. So what went into the place that loves you back? We took a look at other successful slogans, such as Virginia is for lovers and I love New York, and thought that slogans that really did express some kind of relationship between a place and the person probably made the most sense for us, and that Philadelphia was seen as a bit cold, so maybe we should personify the place just as we're doing now with the With Love campaign, where you get letters from Philadelphia, love letters, no less, smash notes, from this person called Philadelphia. And that we did want to express the promise of a good relationship and to warm it up. And we used place because we were talking about Philadelphia and the surrounding counties. We felt that the strength of the cell was the region and the fact that you could do a variety of things in it. We also felt that as a city, to pit it against New York, Boston, D.C. at the time probably put it at a little bit of a disadvantage because it wasn't quite visitor ready. You know, the investment in the stuff that made it a destination hadn't all been made yet. So we picked place also because we wanted to get across the sense of place that you could have in Philadelphia. We also argued about the word Philadelphia. Some people didn't really want it in there, saying that it would be a turnoff. And we said, how can you have a slogan about a place when you don't name it? And they pointed out that, well, the zoo is called Zoo One. It's not called Philadelphia. And Wharton doesn't identify itself as being in Philadelphia. And we said, well, that's all true, but, you know, we have to break some barriers here. There was also a big, big, long conversation about whether it should be Philadelphia or Philly. And people felt Philly was too cheesesteak, and also that it implied an affection that people really didn't feel, that it should be the more formal Philadelphia. Then we wanted to be a little more active than Virginia's for Lovers. Maybe you are, maybe you're not. I love New York, but does New York love you? So that's where we got into the Philadelphia place that loves you back, implying some mutuality or reciprocity. And we followed that with a campaign that was celebrity-driven, to borrow their influence, that said, this is my Philadelphia. Make my Philadelphia your Philadelphia. So we used those together to get that across. The primary audience was New York. There are just so many people. And we had just so little money. And at the time, that was the center of the world of media, because that was, of course, pre-internet, pre-social media, pre-websites, pre-all that, by just a little. Things were about to change big time. So that was the audience. And also, it was the local people. Because even though Pew decided not to do this psychological campaign, we felt, as you said, that everything here, well, nothing here has a visitors-only sign hung around its neck. It's for everybody. And that the more people saw more people coming in and the more good things that would go up, nothing would change the mental like the physical. So that was the approach.
Thank you very much. And I'd like to invite Richard or Bob to add to the conversation. We're talking about what tourism slogans communicate and maybe some of the benefits and the trade-offs of these slogans as representative of our communities.
I have a little bit to say about this. Meryl, I like the slogan, the city that loves you back, for a lot of reasons. It anthropomorphizes the city, but a slogan speaks more about the people who live here than about the city. Mm-hmm. We're more than a museum. So for me as a tour guide, I find that people's impression that they take away from the city, no matter how grand, no matter how beautiful, depends on the relationship they have with the people when they're here, how they're treated by the hotel concierges, taxi cab drivers, waiters and waitresses, and yes, tour guides too. So I love having loved you back in there because it humanizes the city, and that's what's important. Thanks.
Thanks.
I want to make one, I guess, comment about I think the anthropomorphization of the city, especially in these love slogans in this in the continuing theme of a city, you know, which obviously is a revolution from the Virginias for Lovers and I Love New York, in the sense that only Philadelphia then claims that the city is something capable of actually loving you back. And when I was looking at that, I connected it to something else that I've found, which I'm just going to briefly talk about, and that's what I, about 10 years ago, was doing a lot of research about municipal consolidation. That is, way back when, in the 19th century, when cities in the Eastern Seaboard actually were expanding their jurisdictions, their legal jurisdictions. And I was looking specifically at Jersey City. And I was looking at Jersey City prior to the Civil War. And Jersey City was planning to consolidate with this little township called Van Voorst. It was also in Hudson County. And I was reading the articles in the several newspapers in Jersey City. And the thing that was really striking was that an incredibly large proportion of the discussion about Jersey City consolidating with the township of Van Voorst was in terms of the marriage and marriage contract. And it wasn't just sort of a cute little metaphor that was thrown in there. I mean, it was columns and columns where Jersey City was only referred to as the sort of handsome, strapping groom, and Van Voorst was this blushing bride who was sort of waiting waiting in her room and stuff like this. I mean, columns, whole articles that hardly even mentioned that these were actually municipalities. And that got me interested as to why this was such an incredibly prevalent metaphor. I mean, why they were so strong. And then I looked at the consolidation of the five boroughs, the five counties into the five borough system in New York, where you found something slightly similar in the relationship between New York City, which was then just Manhattan Island, and Brooklyn. Where the contrast there was that Brooklyn, most of the residents of Brooklyn were opposed to the consolidation, and so this was presented as a forced marriage by Tammany Hall, where they discussed things like Brooklyn being forced to suckle Tammany cubs and this sort of stuff. But the marriage metaphor was prevalent. I mean, it was very forceful, and it was used extensively. And it was also used to anthropomorphize cities in terms of love for one of the major economic development tools for cities in the 19th century. Because annexation and the actual geographic expansion of cities was a major economic development tool. Now, I think that there's an obvious parallel in terms of tourism is a major economic development tool, and anthropomorphizing a city in terms of it loving somebody. The difference, of course, is that now Philadelphia, in loving tourists, opens itself up to the transient love of tourists who are going to come and who are going to leave. And it's not the marriage vows that Jersey City and Van Voorst were making for each other. And also it closes off the very sort of Victorian, it closes off that moral rejection that was reflected between Brooklyn that could claim that it was being forced into a marriage contract that it didn't want to be forced into. So it was using love as a moral criteria by which it could both accept and reject an economic development tool. Clearly, it's a lot different in the anthropomorphization of a city that can love, but love for the sake of tourism. It's obviously a parallel that you wouldn't want to make too much of, but I think it does provide a continuity to compare cities in two very different eras, Eastern Seaboard cities in two very different eras.
So I think you're all helping us think about slogans as being about both place and personality. I was reading before the program tonight this wonderful book that I don't think is well known called Imagining Philadelphia. It was written by Philip Stevick, who was a professor of English at Temple. And what he did was analyze travelers' accounts of visiting Philadelphia from sort of a literary point of view. But one of the things he noticed was how travelers would talk about their sensory perception of the place, even more about the people. And it reminded me of my first visit to Philadelphia, which was for the bicentennial in 1976. And it was one of those kind of drive-in and out kinds of visits, because we had family in New Jersey, and we were on the pilgrimage tour, sort of. But what I remember of that visit really doesn't have to do with the people of Philadelphia. But I remember driving, for some reason they had the 18-year-old driving the car, driving across the Benjamin Franklin Bridge and hitting that circle with the weird lightning bolt thing in the middle and feeling very disoriented by that. And trying to figure out parking, right, in this unfamiliar place. And then the one really, I have two distinct memories of the historic district. One was of the new Liberty Bell Pavilion, which had just been opened like a day or two before. And the other was of being in Independence Hall, but it's not of the Declaration Chamber or of anything anyone said about the history. It was of that experience you used to be able to have on the second floor. One of the rangers was very good at playing the harpsichord that was there. I think a lot of you remember this. And that's what I remember from that visit to Independence Hall. So I think we have all kinds of sensory things. I want to pose one more question for the panel, and maybe we'll start with you, Bob, this time. That, you know, Philadelphia is certainly rich in historic places, right? We have that as an asset. And I asked Bob this question first because I know we have this discussion at the tour guide sessions about the historic district, right? Yeah. And what is historic and what's not. So they're an asset, but do they also pose a challenge for promoting Philadelphia to today's visitors? And I wonder, Bob, what your take on that would be.
Thanks, John. One thing, in imagining Philadelphia, I remember there's a quote from Charles Dickens, who hated the city. But the Fairmount Waterworks had been built, and he was impressed by the water pressure in his hotel room. That was the only thing about the city he liked. Yeah, Charlie, I think we definitely still have this disjuncture between history in Philadelphia, and Philadelphia is a living city, and we're going to have to deal with that for a long time. In the 19th century, we dealt with that by playing up manufacturing in the city. Today we have to find other ways to make Philadelphia appealing to tourists, because those of us who are tour guides know, if you walk around the city, the entire city is a historic area. You can't walk on a block. I think any of us who are tour guides could stand on any street corner in Philadelphia and probably give a lecture for an hour on what happened on that block. So, it is a problem, and it's something that Merrill and GPGMC deals with all the time.
Okay. I'll use this one. There are some challenges there, but first I just want to mention a couple things about the place that loves you back, because we knew when it was successful, not only because more and more people were coming, but because of how it was picked up in popular culture. And an ad for blue jeans were the jeans that love you back all of a sudden, and many other things.
Scary.
And just recently, in the last year, the cover of Philadelphia Magazine had Cliff Lee with the guy that loves us back. And City Paper had our own Sam Katz on the front of it with the thing, is the city ready to love Sam? Isn't it said, is the city ready to love Sam Katz back, right? This was on the eve of his first great film. So that's something that means a lot to us. So clearly it struck a chord with people that just keeps continuing. To explain one of our challenges, the first Welcome America that we did was in 1993 to open the Pennsylvania Convention Center. And Mayor Rendell wanted 12 days of free events. I lost 14 pounds doing the first Welcome America and opening that center. But he had been on TV that morning talking about Fort Mifflin. We were doing a Fort Mifflin blast. And so we went to every single event. We went out to Fort Mifflin. A couple from out of town came up to him and said, we saw you on TV. We heard you talking about Fort Mifflin. And so we came right out here to see it. And Ed said, what do you think? And they said, We love it. We just have one question. Why did you build it so close to the airport? And it was at that point we realized that, I mean, we just both kind of stopped because it put a lot into perspective that I'm sure the tour guides have too, because people don't expect things to be real anymore. And they had been Disneylanded a lot. And so the challenge of proving that what is here in Philadelphia is the real deal while still talking in current terms and meeting the needs of current tourists is a real challenge that we really count on the tour guides to address, because as you were saying, there aren't lights and banners and a special radio station and little transportation-y things that happen to you when you approach Independence Mall. When we did surveys and said, have you been to Independence Mall, we would get answers like, what shops are there? So it would be the kind of thing where we felt, okay, you have to give people a lot of extra cues, and that's a big challenge. Another big challenge that has been met very well is make the place cleaner, because people felt it looked neglected and it looked unsafe. And sometimes what they meant by unsafe was there was nobody around and it was dirty, because dirty translated to unsafe. They did like the fact that addresses made sense and they probably wouldn't get lost. They love and still love window boxes and bike racks. They feel it looks very European, and they love how green it is and feel it's possibly the most European-American city, where we think of it as the most American of cities in many ways.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the trade-offs between tourist attractions, in my essay, I ended it by making a little claim that if in fact this, for lack of a better term, sort of glorification of an antisocial reputation that I think you could claim Philadelphia had in some respects, was also a recognition of a tradition of tolerance and relative radical equality that did depend to an extent on not caring about others, that in making some claim to greater intimacy on the part of a city, that you are to some extent in making a claim for stronger community, that claim for stronger community is always going to be a claim for giving up some of that tolerance, and that a stronger community that you in which you are going to have a more intimate relationship is also going to be a community in which you can't accept or can't accommodate as much difference. And that's also the distinction that Jane Jacobs made between cities and suburbs in the life and death of great American cities. She claimed that the lifestyle of a suburban community where there were no streets, where there were no sidewalks, there were streets but no sidewalks, where in order to socialize, you couldn't socialize publicly because you were in your car, that the only way you could socialize is by coming into somebody's house, by walking onto somebody's property and coming into somebody's house. The extent of comfort that you felt inviting somebody into your own house would depend on the extent to which they were somebody that you could recognize and who gave off all the cues of being somebody who you would trust. That is, she described it as being in the suburbs, it's sharing everything or nothing. In the cities, you can have a circumscribed public life, a circumscribed sociality, where you can socialize with people without sharing everything, without having to invite them into your home. And that the requirement of inviting people into your own home means that you're going to have a less tolerant social life because you have to invite people into your home. A social life that occurs on the street can be more tolerant. So it's not just an argument about Philadelphia, but Philadelphia also has this added heritage of tolerance and tolerance and radical equality, which I'd argue is related to a sense of indifference. If you turn that down for a community of greater intimacy, it comes along with a less tolerant community. And that was simply the trade-off that I was suggesting at the end of my essay.
Thank you. I think we'll open the floor now to some questions or comments. Who would like to add to the conversation so far? Yes, Jim?
I recall last year something great that happened. That was the International Arts Festival at the Kimmel Center and with the Paris theme. And something none of you have mentioned is money is a very important part of accomplishing all these things. You have all the slogans you want, but you also have some money. I mention that because I know the Kimmel would love to do it again every other year. And the question is money. The reason this one got off the ground is because Ms. Danberg gave $10 million, or they could have never done it. My question is, we have a multiplicity of organizations you can see here that really do a lot of great things. My question for you is, are there ways these organizations can coordinate more to help create these bigger things and not just depend on the luck of someone that gives some money?
Did everyone hear the question?
Yes, we're going to have to because, as you know, Governor Corbett cut tourism funding across the state. It went from $34 million across the state to $3 million, and that's quite a cut. So GPTMC's line items from the state went from $2.5 million from the state to $128,000, and at the same time, arts and cultural institutions were being cut, and a number of others were being cut as well. We've never depended solely on the kindness of strangers anyway. We do have a dedicated revenue stream being the hotel tax, but it's really not enough. Our budget this year is about $10 to $11 million, depending on how that comes in. Las Vegas's is $285 million. Orlando's is $80 million plus the 100 and some that Disney puts in. I mean, it's difficult to compete. On the other hand, we're in a wonderful location. We have a new story. And the visual arts community took a look at what PIPA did through the Kimmel and has come together for what we're calling the With Art Philadelphia Collaborative, which we've already raised $2 million for, which will center around the opening of the Barnes Foundation, but we're not really going to spend any money until after it opens. The Barnes can open. They don't need us to do that because they have measured admittance anyway. All the millions of people who are going to want to go to the Barnes, it could take years. So instead of 200 to 400 people a week, they'll be able to do 250,000 to 350,000 a year, but there are only 365 days in the year, so do the math, as they say. So what's happening is that the visual artists are coming together, not only as PIPA did, but as the science festival people came together. Necessity is the mother. And we're pooling our resources and balancing things and doing things in a more creative way. And that could last for a little bit of time. But, you know, that runs out, too. So the need to constantly look for more sources of money at a time when, as you said, Lee Annenberg died, Jerry Lenfest has announced he's kind of at the end of his giving. Pew Charitable Trust is more centered on the world than they are on Philadelphia. William Penn Foundation has a new wonderful president, but he hasn't even been there a year. And then you have a lot of other small foundations. What you don't have is a lot of consumer-based companies in Philadelphia who feel that sort of civic engagement in terms of giving. And a lot of them who are here don't really understand why they should fund something for tourism because they're base population is a resident population. certain healthcare companies, for example, like that, just don't see. Although, in the past few years, they've understood and they're coming back. If you know of any really rich people, let us know.
Let us know.
But DRPA isn't allowed to do that anymore. A lot of the funding sources have really restricted, and you know the problems the city has. So right now we're just trying to join together in new creative and conscientious ways and be good partners. But yeah, money is necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in front.
Sure. I understand you've had a lot of success in increasing the number of visitors to New York. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of the obstacles you faced and how you overcame.
The question is about visitation from Europe.
Actually, we don't have nearly enough people from Europe or any place else in the world. The internet has been just wonderful for all of us, but in order to really increase visitation, we need an airport with an additional runway and some airlines that have direct flights, because that's how people want to travel. And then you get back to the money part. In some way, too, because to do a real consumer campaign costs at minimum $3 million a year per country, and you really have to be in the market a long time. The guy who ran Williamsburg for a long time said, you know, when he first came to the job at Williamsburg, there were only about 200 destinations that people went to. Now there are 200 between Boston and Williamsburg, and the number of destinations has increased worldwide. While Philadelphia's international visitation has certainly grown considerably, and we're, what, maybe 12th or something, it's a distant 12th. New York had 9 million international visitors last year. Philadelphia had 400 and some thousand. So it's really way down there. Las Vegas gets, you know, a lot of people, San Francisco, L.A., don't forget Honolulu. There are a lot of parts of the country. So there's a lot more to be done. And people are talking now about emerging markets such as India, Brazil, and China, but we don't have direct flights to and from any one of those at this point. And it's a real problem. That's why Jack Ferguson, head of the PCVB, and I did an op-ed for the Philadelphia Business Journal on why the expansion of the airport is needed, knowing that a new runway and all the other improvements can't happen Tuesday. It'll probably take 10 years, at least. It's already been talked about for 10 years. The convention center, before it opened, took 15 from the time somebody talked about it to the time it was built. So there's still a lot to do.
Bob, what's your experience with international visitors? Do you have a contact with them as a tour guide?
This is kind of wrong. This is
unmuted.
There you go.
Thank you.
Year
to year in the past 10 years, I've seen international, I'm sure a lot of you can back me up on the scene, international tourism increase remarkably. I can say that. As it happens, I was just contacted by a European company to do a cell phone app for European tourists for Philadelphia.
Great.
So, yeah, that's a really good thing, I think. A good start.
Thank you. I saw a question in the back, ma'am. Did you want to ask your question?
Yeah. Good evening, everyone.
Oh, it's
with you. Good to see you. I'm also a creative ambassador with excited about this conversation when we're talking about tourism. I'm in a touristic location. My question is, how do we connect the neighborhoods to the city? Being in the arts and being on the side of retail, how do we make a connection, a stronger connection with this side of the historic district as well as what's happening with Barnes and PMA?
You need to get Steven Starr or Jose Garces to open up. On our
side of market. I'm quiet on that side. And with First Friday, which has become nationally recognized, the demographics and audience is changing. It's going down. Many art galleries are closing. There are new models coming. But how do we really push and market Philadelphia as an arts
That's what With Art Philadelphia, the new campaign that I mentioned, is looking to do. And we also just received word that we're getting a two-year, $800,000 grant from the William Penn Foundation to do what they call placemaking, well, what everybody calls placemaking, to take some of the neighborhoods and areas that do have a concentration or critical mass. You know, people want to go where there are a lot of dots on the map, so that we can highlight those. So we should talk further, because there is a lot of new energy in different parts of the city that haven't really been pulled in and centralized yet. Thanks.
Trash is a big problem.
Trash
is a big problem. I'm working on that, trying to. But I was thinking that if somehow we can introduce for a solution for her, tourism as a subject in the Philadelphia Philadelphia school system, because I know for a fact when my family come to visit from out of town, if we would have like something like you could give me like a kit, like not a kit or like some information to say when your mom or your relatives come in town, here's what you can do for them. We already have it scheduled. This is what you can do. You can go here, you can go there. Basically, when they come in town, you know, they want to get the cheesesteak or the hoagie. But there's so many other things in the city. I mean, a lot of times when my family come, we take them to the Baltimore Harbor or something like that. And it's like, why wouldn't we take them? I know what I'm saying.
The Encyclopedia Project would love to do this for you.
Yeah,
meeting really. Before this, and we talked about exactly what you're mentioning.
And then lastly, I had actually ran for office for the second council district, which would be part of Center City, but is part of the airport. And that was one of the things that came up when I went on the campaign trail. And this, I met people in New York, and they said that they would come here more if it was not that expensive to get from New York to here. And I'm thinking, they said, what Amtrak charges to come from New York here. They said when they stop by New York, they would just shoot over to Philly and come see, because it's so proud and inexpensive here. They would shoot. So if we had a dedicated, and I know that's more money, but if the federal government, we got the federal government to make a more inexpensive and quicker way to get from Philly to New York, then we can tap in on some of the New York, that million.
Yeah.
You know what I'm trying to say.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, we're thrilled that Bolt and Megabus have come, because Bolt and Megabus have greatly increased the number of people who can come at, you know, a very low price. And go to visitphilly.com to the My Philadelphia or My Visit sections for some of the itineraries. And also, You Wish You Knew, spelled as you would text it, as in You Wish You Knew, the best things to do with your family when they come, so you don't have to go to Baltimore.
Yeah. So we'll take two last questions here in the front, and then Sean.
Earlier, you mentioned that visual artists were organizing around. Was that, were you talking about individuals or institutions?
Both. Patricia, I don't know if you want to. Patricia, Patricia's head of.
I'm a visual artist who shoots Philadelphia.
Good. Thank you. Of With Art Philadelphia, and we should probably talk to you a little bit after if you have the time, because it'll be both the makers and the preservers.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Sean.
I was just gonna say, I don't know where, I'm a native Philadelphian, I've never understood where the apologetic nature of Philadelphia has come from. Maybe it's because I've been here all my life, and I don't know, but it is really striking. And I wanted to share a story. I was there in 1997 when the Please and Love You Back slogan was announced on Mountains of Steps. And RC Stop from the PCBB, before they announced what the slogan was going to be, they had people from hospitality industry all lined up on the steps. And they said, fantastic, what the slogan is, and then when the press comes in, you can all yell at once. And he explained that there were a lot of people who had a lot of say in the slogan, and that it represented a lot of areas and a lot of different objectives. And so he said, it's got a promise when you hear it, it's got a promise not to hate it. I work at Eastern State Penitentiary, and we always think that when we get an article in the New York Times, it's actually the most helpful because it's
Right.
Thank you very much. All right, one more, Steve.
Just wondering if there's, if you could just for a moment talk about the big picture things like movies being filmed here or TV shows, and then in particular things like Parking Wars upset me as a Philadelphian, because it shows an image of Philadelphia across the country that I'm sure doesn't match up with what we want to do.
We went on a crusade against parking wars, and the best that we were able to do was get a ton of free airtime on A&E because the show is extremely popular. Yeah, it's negative. Really negative. We get a lot of letters from people. Pardon me?
I didn't realize it was popular.
It is, and that's why they keep doing it, and the more outrageous it gets, the better they like it. And yeah, we get a number of emails from people who say, I'm never coming to your city because I saw what can happen on Parking Wars. Other people who watch more reality TV understand what it's all about and just discount it. Movies do help. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia does help. And what we would really love is a movie like City Slickers that did wonderful, wonderful things for the whole Dude Ranch tourist experience, or something like Dallas or Dynasty that portrayed Denver and Dallas in very positive terms. It's a little harder when you get something like Philadelphia, when the main character dies in Philadelphia, or you get 12 Monkeys when you have some creepy almost dead people, or you have Sixth Sense where people see dead people. So what we're hoping for, and we tease Sharon about all the time, is, you know, give us something like Home Alone. Give us something really fun and travel-loggy. But that hasn't happened quite yet. Sam, happy. Yellow Fever, you're giving us Yellow Fever.
The encyclopedia also gave you cholera.
Yeah.
So we're going to segue here and give everyone a chance to participate. I'd like to remind you that part of the goal of our program is to give you the opportunity to help us shape what the Encyclopedia of Greater Philadelphia will be. And so on those comment sheets you have, please continue to jot down things that you would like to see, ideas, whether they're related to what we're talking about tonight. So we'll give you a chance to circle around. There are several people in the room prepared to facilitate further discussion for the last 15 minutes of the evening. Sam Katz is here in the front. Joe Harrow, wave your hand, Joe. Byron Lee, who's back there. Sean Kelly, who you just heard, is up here. And Albert Lee, also known as Mr. Philadelphia, is in the back with his laptop.
What was that?
So please circle your chairs, get to know each other, and continue the conversation this evening. We have 15 minutes left in the evening. The panelists will join you in groups. They're not going anywhere.
Yeah, you know what? This might have been before email. I don't think I have it on email. Maybe I can scan it and get it to you that way.
That would be great.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think they're open here. Otherwise, I'd say, hey, Ben.
How are you?
Yeah, fine.
That's right.
Yes, you did.
You know, I have a green meat tray bread from here.
12 years of 1900. My email is not adequate.
New York and Brooklyn.
I was so warmed by it.
Well, talks about how exactly the same thing is going to happen in Camden.
Oh, that would be great. Okay.
So Camden plays
for
me.
Oh, fine.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
I can email it to you.
Yeah. I'd love it. That would be great.
Yeah. Thank you both for your great comments and insights.
Would you have time, actually? I'm doing a sort of academic paper, but it's based on this. Would you have time to talk at some point?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me give you my. Oh, I put it back here.
Yeah, I think you'd enjoy that.
Thanks,
you're
talking
more bad news for you. Actually,
yeah.
My name's AJ.
Oh, I thought you were going to be
Rebecca, doing my business part.
Okay.
Not connected to what I do here, but my son runs a site called Joy in Philadelphia.
Ooh.
A long time
filled out the resume. That's a great page.
Well, there's so many
things
up there that are good
support. Yeah.
RG43?
Yeah, at Drexel Bank.
That's from Star Wars.
I wonder if I'm familiar with
that. All
right, thank you. The lady stood up and said, gee, when my family comes in and we're not sure what to do, I know there's a lot of official places to do that.
From that article, I got contacted by Brian Tierney, who told me that Rich Russo was the guy who originally came up.
And he's mentioned in there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Then when I was sitting here,
while you're looking, you also have more bad news.
Oh, what?
You may not want to see the show, The Walking Dead, one of the hottest shows on AMC.
No.
There's a two.
I don't.
The two
what
episode arc.
Oh, no.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Sorry about that. And my assistant's name is Denise.
Okay.
One second, Jane. And the best way is to email her at denise@gptmc.com.
Okay.
That would be a good way. And tell her we talked, and she knows her name.
Great.
Yeah, and that would be fun to talk.
Great, thanks a lot. That's really helpful.
No, I'd enjoy it. Love talking about this stuff. Yeah, Rich Russo's mentioned in here, and then he moved to New York.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Quickly thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which was a loss. He was a very creative guy.
Yeah.
Sure. Here.
I'm a business consultant, but
thank
that's
you.
Just a different one. This is my son's son.
Hence the OJ. Oh, good. Thank you.
And it's Steve, right? Was I calling him?
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Art or AJ, either.
All right. Well, you look very much like, too.
I look like somebody
else. My grandfather.
Yes. Yeah. Who attended last time.
So you're steeped in
the
show. I've got a lot of rings looking.
I'm very sorry.
No, that's okay.
That's true. I never knew him, but it's definitely interesting. It's a unique name, so a lot of people recognize it. It's interesting to see who recognizes it.
Yeah.
For a long time, it was a lot of postal workers. Interestingly, like really, and also police that were too young to have remembered him.
Yeah.
I mean, the sort of.
But there is kind of.
Oh, he just gave up his.
There is. Yeah.
There is.
Yeah. No, it's. Yeah. No, it's interesting. And. No, I was three.
Which is why everything happens.
So everything I've ever heard is this family story. I was actually only recently I actually saw a moving clip of them on a TV clip.
Oh, that's a good question.
It's a strange. It's sort of surreal because I live in Philadelphia.
And you have an interesting approach. I enjoy listening to, so I'll look forward to talking about it.
Good. Yeah. No, this was really fascinating.
And I always like
it shouldn't take so much research.
No, there's one more. We'll announce it at the end. And also, thank you for the co-sponsorship of this, which didn't happen at the beginning. March 28th, we're doing City of Neighborhoods at the Philadelphia History Museum. With the big map on the floor.
Is it now no longer called the Atwater Kent?
No, it's the Philadelphia History Museum at Atwater Kent.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And he was here, yeah. And I saw him just slip out the door.
Oh, I didn't see him.
Yeah.
Okay.
And thank you all so much for doing this. And we were talking to Patricia, before the meeting about, the things that we're trying to gear up to do with the encyclopedia that fit perfectly with the arts initiative.
Oh, good.
That you have in mind. The people at the Philadelphia Museum of Art right now are helping us sort of map out the research for us to do on arts, visual arts. So there may be some research connections that would match up with your project. So hopefully we'll continue to explore those.
Do you want us to
I think it would be lovely if you want to sit in with the group, but we're only going to let them go about 5 minutes longer. So
your choice. All right.
You can
eavesdrop
a little. And
then what's going to happen? Then
we're just going to close up.
Okay.
And berate everyone to turn in their forms.
Is there anything, are there any next steps that you'd like, besides looking at the table of contents?
No, the next step is the table of contents.
Okay.
And if you do that, you can also think whether there's anything else you want to find out. I think we want to give people like...
They run into people.
Have you enrolled... I don't know if you ever knew Polly Gross. She moved to UP Austin.
Yeah. I didn't know she moved.
But
she's on my list, yes.
She's still obviously...
She was on our panel last March for City of Brotherly Love.
Oh, okay.
And she wasn't the essay writer, she was on the panel. But I didn't know she loved her time.
Well, it doesn't matter. I mean, she obviously...
This is one of the things, as you're doing the table of contents, as people pop into your head, we would sure like to know who they are, so we can invite them to do what they wish.
No
I'm
problem.
Starting to write essays, too.
And then there was a gun battle going on.
Did you get much from the... I don't know how you pronounce the acronym, MAPACA, the focus group where people are sticking notes to
the... Yeah, if you go onto our website and click on the make a nomination thing, the whole list is there.
Oh, okay.
And when you scroll down to the bottom, you'll see there's a huge list. And so that now is, and when you work on the table of contents, you should look through that and see if there's stuff actually from them or from anybody.
Cool.
That you want to make sure we include.
We
know a lot, but we don't
have
I know.
They just don't want to let go of that.
And we're in Fort Worth, and we're talking to people down from Philadelphia and said, oh, that place where you throw snow.
Well, you're going to adjourn this.
Yeah, I'm going to adjourn about 5 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah, right. There were circumstances. Yeah. And it was 40 years ago. Get another.
I'm not telling you anything you don't know.
Yeah, it's something you get stuck with and you do. Take care. I look forward to your call. Yeah, you get stuck with it, then you have to deal with it.
So, could one approach be turned into a pattern yourself?
That could be dangerous. Well, I think people just have to get trained for that. Like a lot of the young people
And I have to say, from the historical perspective, too, as they mentioned about the slide from there, how many people that live in the Philadelphia region
this is true. I'm about to put in a grant proposal that's on the subject to reduce background to current events for the report, the young reporters today. Something will happen in the news, and a 25-year-old reporter doesn't know what everyone else in Philadelphia knows about that subject. And so what we'd like to do is be pushing out the right information to them.
I've been to Saratoga. Every time we decide to go for some reason, we don't go. And it's kind of, I know it's there and I can go every time I want, so I don't go.
So you don't go. There's no sense of it.
Really?
Yeah, exactly. If you heard it was going to close,
but if it was something cool to do there, too, I would know what's cool there. So I'm pretty like every man in the area.
Really?
And we didn't know what to do about it.
Although we feel bad about it, we did a national survey about 35,000 people. And we wanted to, what we were really trying to do was being able to see the recognition
That's I know, if you want to give me your name, I'm going to tell you to tell my
mom. I told my husband that I'd be in the building, he's waiting for me.
Yeah, I'm going to let them go 3 or 4 more minutes.
But this was really great.
Oh,
thank you. You gave a wonderful setup.
It was fun. I'm preparing myself to write what I say about the person for the assembly. Oh, thank you.
I don't want to hold you up.
No, that's fine.
This is a change in the number.
What?
One reason why people come to Philadelphia is because people do.
There wasn't any one major reason.
Realtor, she's sort of not practicing a little bit, but she's still got her license and she changed Realtor at 7th Street. I guess right after they moved out of 12th Street, you still live?
I now live in Queensville.
Oh, okay.
I do. And all the way to Queensville. So after I was told to evacuate my house on Alpers Alley, which I had been renting for 10 years, I moved to Queensville. And I have one daughter.
Do you need extra shelter?
Yeah, I'm
41. Yeah. And luckily, after I'm here today,
it was the appearance response. This one was very nice. But still, the response was.
What's her name? Okay. Not the fashion.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to interrupt you just momentarily. I always hate to break up these great conversations. You can feel free to carry them on, but it's 8 o'clock. And I want to give some thanks very much to the GPTMC who co-sponsored this with us this evening, our friends at HSP who helped us with all of the logistics, and of course the Pennsylvania Humanities Council for their sponsorship. I'd like to remind you that you have 2 pieces of paper. We really want your ideas for the encyclopedia. You can put them on the comment form along with your email address if you'd like to be on our email list. Please also fill out your evaluation forms. We are doing 2 things to make your participation tonight part of the record of the encyclopedia. There'll be a written summary of the program that we'll post on our website, and eventually there will also be an audio recording of the panel and the questions and answers. So on behalf of the encyclopedia team, I want to thank you very much and let you know we have one more program in this series. Please join us on March 28th at the Philadelphia History Museum at the Atwater Kent for City of Neighborhoods, City of Homes. Good evening, everyone.